So I'm going to talk about conformal loop ensembles in the Gaussian free field. The first half of the talk will be mostly going over the Gaussian free field and describing how it is that this is connected to SLE. And so some in the audience know about this and others don't. The second half of the talk I'll then get more into describing the conformal loop ensembles and how they can be constructed. So references, so there's this contouralized the two-dimensional discrete Gaussian free field. This is our long 130-page paper that we have on the archive recently, and it heavily uses these two other papers, Harmonic Explorer and Gaussian Free Fields for Mathematicians, which is sort of a survey of how, at least I like to think of what Gaussian free fields are. And then there's this other paper, Exploration Trees and Conformal Loop Ensembles, that's not on the archive yet, but I have it right here. So if anyone wants to look at this, you're welcome to. So it's nearly complete, and I'm happy to let people look at that. And also there are some slides and figures on my and online lectures on the website, my website, which includes a description of some work in preparation. So a number of things that aren't finished yet. Well, first of all, what is chordal SLE? Well, this has been defined a few times, but I want to do a quick review. So this is a random fractal path in a planar domain. I give you simply connected planar domain, two boundary points, A and B, starting and ending point, and it's a random path connecting one of those points to the other. It has a real parameter, kappa, which more or less describes how windy the path is. If kappa is zero, the path is smooth. It's a straight line if this is the unit disk with opposite endpoints. The higher kappa gets, the more this path tends to wind back and forth. It's a simple path almost surely when kappa is less than or equal to 4. The space-filling path winds so much that it fills the whole domain almost surely when kappa is equal to or greater than 8. It's the conjecture scaling limit of many random paths from statistical physics. In the precise definition, it's a Loebner evolution driven by root k times a Brownian motion. And it's characterized by the conformal Markov property, which says that if I take any other domain, so first the conformal invariance property says if I take any other domain and look at an SLE kappa in this domain, its law is the same as the law I would get if I took an SLE kappa in this domain and then took a conformal map and looked at its image over here. So that's the conformal invariance. So if I define SLE for one domain, I basically have in one pair of boundary points. I then have a definition for all domains and all pairs of boundary points because I can map this definition over to another domain. And then the Markov property says that if I run this path up until some fixed stopping time, so I run the path up until some stopping time, say the first time it exits some ball or something, I run the path up till that time, I condition on the path till that time, and that's the conditional law of the rest of the path. The conditional law of the rest of the path should be the same as the original law after a conformal map. So it should be simply an SLE in the original domain minus the path thus far, with the tip as its starting point and the original target as the target point. Okay, so any questions first about the definition of SLE or what the conformal Markov property is before we go on? If we can. Okay. I think this is given for now. So three vexing questions about SLE. So the first one, been a big question from the beginning, is does SLE kappa have a time reversal symmetry? I.e., is SLE kappa from A to B the same as SLE kappa from B to A? So if you like draw an SLE from A to B, look at a conformal map that swaps B and A, and ask whether the law of the image is the same as the original law. So everyone believes this is true for kappa between 0 and 8, and it's known to be false for kappa bigger than 8. And in most of the discrete models that are believed to converge to SLE, this sort of symmetry is obvious. So when kappa is equal to 6, for example, and this is the boundary of percolation, then you know, you put white clusters on this boundary, black clusters on this boundary, look at this interface between them, it's sort of clear that, I mean, you can take that you're, that it has to have this sort of symmetry, because you can take your graphs to have that symmetry. Okay, so the second question is, if kappa is bigger than 4, is the boundary of SLE kappa in some sense a form of SLE kappa prime, where kappa prime is 16 over kappa? So recall that when SLE is bigger, when kappa is bigger than 4, the path hits itself. So it's not a simple path. So if you run it up to some stopping time and then you look at the boundary, say one side of it, you have a random path. And so again, it's believed this should be some form of SLE. It should look locally anyway. It should have the same properties of SLE 16 over kappa. So these two questions, so I'm never very good at figuring out who I should assign credit for having these ideas, but certainly you know, several people in this room, as well as Duplantier, Nienhuis, have asked this question.
Another question about the
yes.
One.
Uh-huh.
Is that equivalent to saying that the left boundary of SLE is the left, you know, the SLE Karp domain is in two halves, say, and so is it equivalent to say that the left part is the same as the traditional equivalent to the right part? The time reversal equivalent to time reversal, right?
Well, I mean, you have the reflection symmetry is known. That's sort of clear from the definition that it's, you have a reflection symmetry. So I guess no is the answer to the yes.
Is one still puzzled over why one isn't obvious? I mean, suppose the domain is a disk and you're trying to travel from the bottom to the top.
Mm-hmm.
You do 180 degree rotation, interchanging bottom and top.
Mm-hmm.
Why doesn't the conformal invariance, particular locational invariance, transform the law from moving from top to bottom and the law from top to bottom?
So, conformal invariance, it comes with a fixed set of boundary points.
So, in other words, it's not known to be conformally invariant
if it swaps the endpoints. That's right. That's what's not known. So
I'd actually like to return to my question, because it seems to me that when I look at SLE, when I look from the right side, it moves left to right. Okay. Whereas when I look at it from the left side, it moves right to left. So isn't that the same question? Because if I want to compare those two, I would like to compare them, you know, when I know that it moves left to right, and it would only be possible if I look at a reversal.
Left to right, right to left. I'm not sure what you're saying.
You follow its evolution.
Yes?
You look, when you look to the right of the path, the ultimate path, you see it move from the left to right. Okay, so you see the evolution like that. But when you look from the other side,
I think it's a question of whether the picture on the right is embedded under reflection, which we know it is, or 180-degree rotation.
This is what I'm asking. 180-degree rotation is...
Oh, I see. So you mean the left side, if you do 180-degree rotation, should be the same. Then that would be equivalent, at least when cap is 4 or less.
If you can probe it locally, you can just look at, you know, how the winding number goes and things like that.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, you could... I mean, I guess one way to convince yourself it's not obvious is to note that it's false when kappa is bigger than 8. So, you know, there has to be something. It's not just true from the conformal symmetry that SLE has. Yes?
Right at the start.
No,
that's good. I don't understand your answer because you said that you have to fix the beginning and end point. But you're talking about the transformation between two different domains.
So if I give you two domains.
I consider two disk domains, both are ground disks, and in each case, the beginning and end points are top and bottom, but they're just reversed by the 180 degree rotation, which is the formal identification.
Yeah, that's right. So what? Okay. The conformal invariance. I will define on one domain SLE. It is a path with a starting point and an end point. A and B. Once I've defined it on one domain, on any other domain with a marked starting point and a marked ending point, the SLE is, if you like, by definition, just the image of this one under a conformal map. So that means, but if I, and so that's the only definition I have. So if I give you this 180-degree rotated disk, and now I conformally map A to here and B to here, then what I get is an SLE going from here to here.
Obviously, if you define it just on one domain and then transport the definition by conformal maps and it's conformal invariant, so there's less factors.
Yes, that's right. That's exactly right. The conformal invariance we have is...
That's the definition, but then it makes sense, for example, when you look at scaling limits, discrete models, and you can say, I take the scaling limits in two different domains, and then at this level, the statement of conformal invariance really starts to make sense. I mean, it has some meaning.
Yeah, but if you prove that scaling limits are conformally invariant, then it's obviously true that that there is time inversal symmetry on the SLE curves.
Yes. That's right. That's right.
So
that's correct.
Well, for some values of kappa, it's known because.
Yeah, so for kappa equal to 4,
if it, if
6,
it rises
8.
The scaling limit, if that's all you're interested in, then you can forget about one.
Yeah, well, if you're willing to assume it arises as a scaling limit of one of these models that has this symmetry, then yes, one is obvious.
But it's not a cool thing, right?
It's only for pedantic mathematicians that we worry about one. So this is believe it, I think. Well. Yes?
In the picture which you draw there, the whole area around A is swallowed by the path, but you can't follow the whole area around B. You can follow that either right or the left side, which you're coming from.
We can't swallow the area around B.
Yeah, and smaller either. I mean, every coming you bound to the boundary before to the left or to the right of
B. Yes.
And then this you will swallow when you write it. You can't swallow the other thing.
So, what is swallowed is everything that, there's always one component of the domain, of the complement of the path, that has B on its boundary. And what is swallowed is everything except for that. So if the path goes over to here, then this is swallowed. If the path then goes over to here, then this is swallowed.
Just continue then until you reach B. Either some part left or some part right of B will not swallow.
No, because this, as it hits B, when it gets to here, all this is swallowed. Then when it goes to here, all this is swallowed. Here, all this. Ultimately, everything is swallowed. It goes back and forth on either side of B before it actually gets to B.
No, last time it touched
the Yeah. Okay. Okay, so these are two questions. The next question is, can you construct and understand some natural family of SLE kappa loops, which we call conformal loop ensembles, CLE kappa. So a lot of these physical models, percolation, OM models, FK cluster models, you have easing model, you have random collection of loops. You look at the interface between plus and minus spins in an easing model. That's, you have some collection of loops. And if you say, well, you know, I can fix the boundary so I have one natural chordal path, and ask if that chordal path converges to SLE, but then it's natural to ask, well, what about the set of all the loops? Can I understand what the other loops are doing that aren't part of this chordal path? And well, these are the questions that we're working on. And so for one, so I have an argument with Oded that works at least when kappa is equal to less than 4, and maybe will work for kappa up till 8. It might take us a year to finish writing this up, but it uses the Gaussian free field, and I'll say a little more later about where that comes from. When kappa is bigger than 4, this I can give you an answer to, and also in terms of the Gaussian free field. And 3, the answer is also yes, and this is what's in this draft of a paper I have here, and it includes an additional work with Wendel and Werner. So, I want to stress that all of these things can be described in terms of the Gaussian free field, which is, in some sense, a very simple object. Sometimes physicists call it the trivial field, or the, you know, it's also called the massless free field, or the Euclidean bosonic massless free field. It's something that probably everyone in this room understands on some level. But I'll first say what the discrete version of this is. So, okay. So I give you a standard Gaussian on n-dimensional Hilbert space. So just to fix some notation, this has density function e to the minus inner product of e with itself divided by 2 times an appropriate constant. And so I'm just giving you n-dimensional space. You have an inner product, and this is your usual bell-shaped curve. And you can also write a sample from this distribution as a sum of alpha sub I times v sub I's, where the v sub I's are some orthonormal basis, and the alpha sub I's are IID Gaussians. And so I'll always refer to this as the standard Gaussian on a Hilbert space. Now, the discrete Gaussian free field is defined as follows. First, I define the Dirichlet energy of a real-valued function f on the vertices of a planar graph to be given by this function. So h of f is the Dirichlet inner product of f with itself, where this Dirichlet form is just defined to be the sum over all nearest neighbor edges of the difference in one function across that edge times the difference in the other function across that edge. So the Dirichlet inner product of f with itself is just the sum over all edges in the graph of the height change squared across that edge of the graph. So now, to define the Gaussian functor, what I do is I fix a function f on the boundary vertices, and the set of functions that agree with this f naught, this boundary function, is isomorphic to Rn, where n is the number of interior vertices. And I define the discrete Gaussian free field to be a random element of this space whose probability density is e to the minus h of f, this energy of f over 2. Okay, so so the energy is smallest when you have a constant function, then the Dirichlet energy is 0. The more the function varies, the larger the energy is. So this e to the minus the energy will be smallest when you have a will be largest when you have a constant function, and basically this weighting penalizes functions that fluctuate a lot. Here's a picture of what this looks like on a 20 by 20 grid with zero boundary condition. So just an instance of this discrete Gaussian free field. And as you see, nearest neighbors want to be close to each other, so it's somewhat continuous, but there's also a lot of random fluctuation from the noise. Okay, so some basic properties of this discrete Gaussian free field are the following. First is, okay, if I give you zero boundary conditions, then this Dirichlet form, inner product of f with itself, it's an actual inner product on the space of functions with zero boundary. And discrete Gaussian free field is simply the standard Gaussian on this space. If I give you a different set of boundary conditions, then f naught, then the discrete Gaussian free field is an affine translation of the one with zero boundary condition. That is, it's the same as the one with zero boundary conditions plus a deterministic function, which is simply the discrete harmonic interpolation of f naught to the rest of the graph. So, so in other words, if I give you a grid like this, and I tell you what the law of the field is when I have zero boundary conditions, and then I ask, well, what's the law if I give you some other boundary conditions, f naught? Well, what you can do is you interpolate f naught to a discrete harmonic function in the whole domain. Discrete harmonic function means its value at every vertex is the average of the values at the neighboring vertices. So there's a, and you can think of it as the discrete harmonic function at this point is equal to the expected value of f naught of the first time, the first place that a random walk started at this point hits the boundary. So if I give you boundary values 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 1, 2, 2, 2, 3, 4, 3, 4, and I start a random walk here, there's going to be some expected value of the value of f naught at the first place this random walk hits the boundary, and that value will depend on the starting point of the random walk, so it's a function of the starting point, and that function is the discrete harmonic interpolation. Okay. So that's one property of the discrete Gaussian free field. Once you understand it with zero boundary conditions, you understand it with any boundary conditions. And the next property is this Markov property, which says that if I condition on the values of the field on some subset, conditioned on the values on this subset, the law of the values inside is only depends on the boundary values of this set, and it's And it's exactly just a discrete Gaussian free field with boundary values given by the values you're conditioning on. Okay. Now the continuum Gaussian free field, so I think of it as it's a standard Gaussian on an infinite dimensional Hilbert space. So given a planar domain D, I let H of D be the Hilbert space closure of the set of smooth compactly supported functions on D under this Dirichlet inner product. So the Dirichlet inner product of F1 and F2 is just the integral over the domain D of the dot product of the two gradients. And so the Dirichlet energy is just the integral over the domain of the dot product of the gradient with itself, the norm of the gradient, L2 norm of the gradient, squared. And so this is okay, let's, so this is, so you can define this for smooth functions and then just take its completion and you get a Hilbert space. Now, so one way to view this Gaussian free field is it's the formal sum. H is the sum of alpha sub I, F sub I's, where the F sub I's are an orthonormal basis for H, and the alpha sub I's are IID Gaussians. And this sum does not converge pointwise. That's the problem. So H, it isn't really defined as a function if you define it this way. But H can be defined as a random distribution. What I mean by that is that sort of the pairings, if you like, I'll call it inner product of H with a smooth function, is well defined. If I look at a partial sum of this, I can take its inner product with a smooth function. And this is almost surely going to converge for every smooth function. So H almost surely is an honest distribution. It's a mapping from smooth functions to numbers. So another way to think of it is that if I define H on a disk, then the value of H at a point is not well defined. But if I ask what's the average value of H on a small disk, that is a well defined number. If I give you any disk, the average value on that disk is a well defined number. And this is going to be a continuous function of the center and the radius of the disk. And if you know all these averages, you know the field. So it's not really as complicated an object as it seems to be. You know, if you like, just think about these averages on disks, and this is a random continuous function of the center and the radius. So I want to stress two other things. One is that if I did this in one dimension, so instead of having a disk, I just had an interval, and I took this integral, then what I would get is the Brownian bridge on that interval. And in that case, this sum would almost surely converge pointwise. And the other thing I want to stress is that this inner product is conformally invariant. So you should notice sort of obviously rotationally invariant, because rotating doesn't change the L2 norm of the gradient. And it's also sort of obviously scale invariant. If I rescale by a factor A, kind of stretch out by a factor of A, then I multiply my area by A squared, but I divide each of these things by a factor of A, the gradients. So the integral is the same. And a conformal map is just locally, a rotation and a rescaling. So we have this conformal symmetry. Okay. So now let's do some examples. Let's see, do I have one of these sticks? No, I guess not. Just a pointer? No, I don't like those. Okay. All right, so here let's do specific example, let's say I give you this as my graph, and I fix the boundary values to be one constant on the black vertices on the boundary, and another, oh, very good, and another constant on the white vertices of the boundary. And then, given those boundary values, I sample an instance of the Gaussian free field. And I'll assume it's, so it says it's negative on these values, positive on these white values. And then I'll color the values inside black if the height is negative there, and white if the height is positive there. So here I've got an instance of the Gaussian free field, but I'm only showing you the signs. Black is negative, white is positive. Now here's a dual version of this picture. I've just replaced each vertex with a hexagon. So these were my boundary values, and I chose the inside ones randomly. And as you can see here, there's a natural interface separating black from white. And when I'm negative on one side of the interface, positive on the other. And if you think about it, what this interface corresponds to is, if I were to look at this picture up here and interpolate the function linearly on each triangle, so I have the values on the three endpoints of the triangle, I just interpolate linearly to the interior, then there will be a level line of height 0 that starts at some point between here and here, the value is 0, and then it's piecewise linear, and there's a place where we have a 0 in between each black and white along an edge. And if you think about it, the edges that this zero level line crosses are precisely those edges whose duals are in this path. So if I want to understand the, you know, piecewise linearly interpolated function and look at its level lines, I just have to understand interfaces between positive and negative of this form. So we'll mostly use this hexagon picture. Now this theorem with Oded that's in that long paper I mentioned is that if the initial boundary heights are lambda on one boundary arc and minus lambda on the complementary arc, where lambda is a particular constant, so it's root pi over 8 if you scale your discrete field so that they converge to the regular Gaussian free field. So then you have to have this constant, root pi over 8. Then the scaling limit of the zero height interface, as the mesh size tends to 0, is SLE4. So let me show a picture to make clear what I mean. So here I actually did this on sort of a 90 by 90 hexagonal grid. I put minus lambda boundary conditions over here, and plus lambda boundary conditions over here, and then sampled an instance of the Gaussian free field, and I've just shaded these things according to the height, according to the value of the function, so darker is lower, lighter is higher. And I drew here the interface between the positive and the negative hexagons. And so you see you get some random fractal path. As the mesh size gets finer, the limit of this path is SLE4.
Can we understand what happens if I choose the constant lambda to be different? What will look different then?
Yes, yeah, so I'll get to that in a moment.
You have some normalization on the field when it's lambda.
Yes. Yeah. So the stiffness. So first of all, for the regular Gaussian for the Gaussian free field on a disk, there's a natural normalization because there's where normalization where the inner product is just this so the L2 norm is a natural object, right? The integral of so the L2 norm of the gradient is a natural object. And so if I take my energy to be the L2 norm of the gradient squared, and so I'm
With
coefficient of 1/2.
Yes, it's
a 1/2 in the charge. So yeah, it's just the standard Gaussian. I could rescale it. I could multiply it by a constant, and that would you can put in a beta, but that's sort of the canonical one. like the standard Gaussian, as infinite dimensional Hilbert space. If you take that and you choose your discrete, you choose the stiffness for your discrete ones so that they converge to that, then there's a canonical choice for lambda, which is this root pi over 8. I mean, another canonical choice, I should say, is you choose the is you let your discrete Gaussian be just the sum over the edges of the height difference squared. Don't multiply that by a constant. And if you do that, then what you get agrees up to something like the fourth root of 3 times some sort of messy constant. Okay. So here's a surface plot of the same thing. So it's positive here, negative here. You can see the random fluctuations. Now, what I did to get this picture is I said, let's just look at the heights, not everywhere. Let's just look at the height values on either side of the interface. So I'm only going to look at the values of the function on either side of the interface. And then, conditioned on those values, I ask, what is the expected value everywhere else? And so on these values that aren't incident to the interface, I'm showing you the expected value of that, conditioned on the values along the interface. And because of this Markov property I mentioned before, what this is exactly the discrete harmonic interpolation of the value minus lambda here, the value on the interface here on this side, and plus lambda here, the values of the interface here on this side. So you want to sample the Gaussian free field, look at its values on either side of this path, fix those, then take the discrete harmonic interpolation to the rest, you get this. And the thing that jumps out at you from this picture is that you really have basically a constant on this side and another constant on this side. And in the surface plot, that sort of becomes even more clear. Along this interface itself, you have a lot of random fluctuations. But once you get a few lattice spacings off, you know, even here, just, you know, 5 or 10 lattice spacings away, it really starts to look just like one constant on this side and just like another constant on this side. And that constant is lambda. It looks like plus lambda over here and minus lambda over here. And this sort of constant, this describes sort of a height gap. When I draw this level line, there's a gap in the height expectation from one side to the other. And that gap remains in the limit. So it's actually, this height gap is a feature not only of the discrete, but also of the continuum field.
Yes?
And I would have thought in that so-called flat region that you would have had logarithmic fluctuations where in L, where L is the min and min system.
Yeah, this is the conditional expectation. So, okay, so let's see. So does it get large? Along here? Yes, yes, it certainly does.
Except to be zero on the line, right?
So it's minus lambda here and here, and it's plus lambda here and here. And the interface, there is sort of a path along here where the height is exactly zero.
That's
right.
So why do you have peaks higher than lambda in expectation?
I'm conditioning not just on where the path is, I'm also conditioning on what the heights are on the hexagons on either side of the path.
From your sample?
From my sample. So, you know, if you think about it, you can imagine generating this path dynamically and only looking at the hexagons you need to. Start walking, you look at a hexagon, well, tell me your value. If it's negative, you turn right. If it's positive, you turn left. You see another hexagon, tell me your value. And turn, depending on its sign. And continue. And then when you see that at some stopping time, at that, up to that point, you've seen a bunch of negative values here and a bunch of positive values on the other side. But the negative values, what are they? I mean, they're not always the same. There's some random fluctuation. They're always less than zero. You know, so they, what do they tend to be on average? Well, they tend to be a little less than zero on average. And the ones on the right side tend to be a little bigger than zero on average. And if you measure this average in this harmonic sense, then it's sort of average of lambda on this side and average of minus lambda on the other side.
So following up on Mike's question, I mean, when you actually take expectation of these values as well,
mm-hmm.
do you get exactly lambda or no?
In the discrete cases? Or when you take expectations over these heights on the,
right.
So you only condition on the path, not on the heights. No, you don't get exactly lambda in the discrete case. You get it in the limit. You have exactly lambda, but not for any particular discrete.
Well, in the limit, when you're away from the interface, right? I mean, if you take the limit, when you just follow a point, one line is facing away from the interface.
No, you won't have exactly lambda there, no. It's going to depend on the geometry of the path. You know, when it goes out, I mean, some places, even if I just condition on the path, at some places the expected height will be bigger and some places smaller. We can go into this later, but, you know, try the veriest simple example you can, you know, like a 3-hexagon graph, and you'll find a counterexample to what you're suggesting. Yes? Okay, so I guess a way to phrase your question would be look at a hexagon and ask what is the absolute value of the expected height at that hexagon after I do this. And we know it will be approximately lambda. You know, tend to be plus lambda if it's on the right side, minus lambda if it's on the other side. Is it lambda in expectation? I don't think so. Again, you know, try an example with 5 or 6 hexagons, and I think you'll see that's not true. There's no reason that.
High probability is either lambda or minus lambda.
But it will be close to lambda or minus lambda. That's right, with high probability. Yes, close to that. So in the limit, it's going to be lambda. But you don't expect an exact equality in the finite, in the discrete versions. Okay. So this height gap lemma, I mean, I want to really stress that this persists in the limit. So when I take finer and finer grids, I don't have to rescale the height in order to get convergence to the Gaussian free field. So this is different from Brownian motion, where I have to rescale both the vertical and horizontal axis. Here I take a finer grid, but I still have the same amount of typical fluctuation between neighbors in the grid. Then that's what converges to the Gaussian free field. So I let the grid get finer, but I keep the stiffness between neighbors the same. So when I take this path, I'm still going to have the same height gap.
You know, you're in
because I'm in two dimensions. This is a feature of two dimensions. Yes?
Convergence
is
convergence
as I go away from the curve? Let's see. Good question. So, yeah, probably it's exponential.
It's just a few lattice spacings. So
it seems to do the job, a few lattice spacings.
Although it depends on how wiggly the curve is. I mean, if you look at the top part of that curve, then it's much more wiggly. Then.
Yeah, I would have to think about this for. Well, do I have to think about this? I probably don't. I think it is going to be.
Well, it's either a few lattice spacings. I mean, it can't be. I mean, it's in the scaling limit that goes to zero, right?
Yeah, the scaling limit it goes to zero.
Yeah, so it's just some number of things.
So I'd have to think about it.
Isn't it just the behavior of a Green, standard Green's function on a disk? Because, you know, the rock distribution.
Yeah, you should be able to bound it by that. So if you fix the Dirac function at the boundary, then it's going to be exponentially decaying. And how, you know, now you're adding up a sort of sequence of these from all the different terms, but you should still, yeah, you should still get exponential.
Yeah, but the Green's function doesn't decay exponentially.
Well, let's see, how does the Green's function? You're right. Well, it's a power law. No, you're right. It is going to be a power law, I guess. For what is the fluctuation here on a billion by billion grid? Is it exponential in a billion, or is it power law in a billion? I would say, I guess it has to be power law in a billion. Because even if you just look at the contribution from one of these guys, you know, I fix them all except one of these most exposed points, and I just re-randomize that one. That's already going to give you some change. Okay. All right. So, well, let me just stress one more thing over here in this picture, which is that if I were to fix some other boundary conditions, say minus 3 lambda and 3 lambda over here, and look at this interface, the height gap would still be order of 2 lambda. It would still be approximately minus lambda on this side and plus lambda on this side. And in that case, what this would do is it would converge to one of these so-called SLE kappa rho processes, for those who know, they're variants of SLE. What's special about these boundary conditions is that sort of the expected height, the original expected height looks like, you know, if I generate part of the path, then the expected height along this path looks like the boundary. So yes, go ahead. Yes, that's right. For that special value of lambda. So okay. So I want to say a little bit about why this occurs. So first of all, if I take a domain and I draw an SLE4 up to some stopping time, and then I look at the harmonic function, which is minus lambda on the left side and lambda on the right side. So it's lambda on the right side of the original boundary, and then it's just minus lambda on this side and plus lambda over here.
So
now I'm going to do this continuum. The actual value isn't going to matter for what I'm about to say here. So it turns out that, so now what I can do is I draw this continuum path, I can look at the harmonic interpolation. And so if I define h sub t is equal to the harmonic interpolation, so of these, this gamma just of 0 up to time t, boundary values, so by this I mean just what I've written here. I look at the path up to time t and fix minus lambda left plus lambda on the right, minus lambda over here, plus lambda over here. H sub t is the harmonic interpolation of that. So h sub t, you know, if I look at a generic point, h sub t is varying as a function of time, is varying continuously as a function of time. And for SLE4, when kappa equals 4, this h sub t of g is a martingale. it's a continuous martingale, it's a time change of Brownian motion, you can write down what it is very precisely. And it turns out this property characterizes SLE4. So SLE4 is the unique random path with this property, that if I look at the harmonic interpolation of this left and right side, it's a martingale. And this is true for any value of lambda, actually, because changing lambda is just multiplying h of t by a constant. Another way of saying the same property, if you think about it, is that if I fix some point in the interior of the domain, and I ask, what is the probability that, or given the path up to this time, what is the probability that this point ends up on the left side of the path in the end? This is equal to the probability that a Brownian motion started at this point, hits the minus lambda side before hitting the lambda side. So, let me say that one more time. I fix a point z in the interior, condition on my path up to a stopping time, ask, what's the conditional expectation? This point ends up on the left side of the path. It's equal to the probability of Brownian motion started at this point, hits the left side of the boundary, including the left side of the path so far, before hitting the right side. And if you think about it, you can see that's equivalent to what I said here about this thing being a martingale. Because after this path is all the way finished, h sub t will be either minus lambda or lambda. And so the probability it's on the left side just tells me the probability it will be minus lambda. And there's lambda, minus lambda. If the value is two-thirds of the way towards lambda on this interval, then the probability that this point ends up on the lambda side is going to be two-thirds. So h sub t is really just telling you at every point the probability that point ends up on the left. Okay, and this characterizes SLE4. And if you think about it, it should not be surprising from what we have here that we satisfy the same property in the system. Because, you know, I have a discrete version of this h sub t that tells me what's the expected height at this point given, say, the path up to the first t steps. And this expectation is exactly a martingale. But look at an expectation and gradually give you more and more information and update that expectation. The sequence of updated expectations is a martingale, by definition. And and then what I have is that the value at this point is approximately given by this harmonic interpolation. And so in the limit, we'd expect to have this property. Okay, I want to say there's a variant of this construction I can do, which is, suppose now, instead of looking for the zero level line, each time I hit a hexagon, what I do is, instead of comparing the height of the hexagon to zero, to decide whether to turn left or right, I compare it to a constant times the amount of winding the path has done so far. Which I mean the number of left turns minus the number of right turns the path has done so far. So that's some number. And I can say, you know, so if you think about it, if the path spirals in like this, then in order to get here it had to do, it's two revolutions, so it had to do about 12 more right turns than left turns in order to spiral into there. But in order to get out, it has to do some left turns. So at any point, I look at the number of right turns minus left turns I've had so far, and I compare h to that. And if it's bigger, I turn right. If it's less, smaller, I turn left. And here I've got a picture of what that looks like. And
so you compare it to a constant times the winding.
To a constant times the winding number.
And you're going to be free and going to vary this
constant. You can vary this constant. And so for this choice of the constant, it turns out this path looks approximately like SLE 0.7. Yes?
The SLE, whatever, K, has a fractal dimension which is larger than 1.
Yes.
Is it obvious that this path is something which has a fractal dimension which is not 1? Okay, but it's not just a line, but it's denser than a line, it's like the one coming from the Gaussian.
Coming from the Gaussian free field? Well, I mean, it requires proof. Yes, that's right. So sort of the larger the coefficient is, the straighter you'd expect this to be.
So this, I would say, is dimension 1.
In the limit.
Does it mean that this corresponds to k goes to 0?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It corresponds to kappa tending to 0.
So kappa would depend on the coefficient in front of the Gaussian.
Exactly. Yes. Exactly. What's that? Well, I'll say more about this in a minute. So this,
lambda,
what's that?
Fixed lambda. Then if you vary the coefficients into principle.
Well, lambda.
And then you get
absolute. Yeah, lambda actually turns out to. It's sort of chosen for you by the system. It's this height gap. So once you fix the stiffness of the field. But what I like to say is, let's think of the Gaussian free field as being fixed. I have one Gaussian free field, and then I'm taking a constant multiple of my winding that I'm comparing to. So if I were comparing it to 0 times my winding, then I'm just doing a level line. I'm turning right if it's bigger than 0, left if it's smaller than 0. If I'm comparing it to a huge number times my winding, then you know, I'm going to be doing more or less a straight line. Yes, well, so it turns out you can do a continuum analog of this construction where you can actually prove a precise version of this statement, that you can say that the path which is obtained using this winding rule from the continuum Gaussian free field is this SLE. And basically, the way you do that is, I mean, over here I said this h sub t, this harmonic interpolation of these boundary values was a martingale. Well, what I would then do is define h sub d t to be the harmonic interpolation of the boundary values plus the harmonic interpolation of the winding. So it would be this h sub t plus some harmonic interpolation of the winding. Now it turns out if you take that as your h sub t, depending on what constant you multiply by the winding, there's a unique kappa for which this becomes a martingale. And that, again, that characterizes the path. So, you know, at this point, we haven't written down a proof that in the discrete setting, that as you take a finer and finer lattice, the law of this path converges to SLE 0.7. We don't have any doubt that it's true, but we don't have a proof of it in the discrete setting. What we have is a continuum analog
for which we can make
the statement precise.
0.7 mean exactly 0.7, or is that some numerical?
It means exactly 0.7. Let's show you, here's another one. This is SLE 0.2. So here I took a different multiple of the winding, and this path is now approximating SLE 0.2. It's a little bit windier. SLE 2. So a question for what I was alluding to before you can ask is, can you get an actual path-valued function of the Gaussian free field this way? And So the answer to this also turns out to be yes, which to me was surprising at first. So I give you an instance H of the Gaussian free field. So first of all, you can construct a coupling of the Gaussian free field with gamma such that conditioned on the path gamma up to some stopping time t, the conditional law of the Gaussian free field is given by this Gaussian free field in D minus the path so far with these boundary conditions given by winding plus minus lambda. Yes?
So if I look at the law for this random walk model you're talking about, having grown the curve up to some time t, so I have some number with the number of right turns minus left turns.
Yes.
And I look at the law of the continuation of the curve. How can that be the same as the law in the domain of the cut for the curve that's already been grown? Because in that domain we have no number, which is the number of left turns minus right turns up to that point. And this is conforming.
So the conformal Markov property, I mean, it's only true in the limit, it's not true for the... Oh, you're saying because we now have, on the original boundary we didn't have these funny boundary conditions? Is that what you're asking? So, why don't I say this? Well, okay, let me say this. If you...
I think the puzzle is that this random winding seems to have a memory and the puzzle marked up with no memory.
Yes, okay. So that's a good point. Let me...
But I guess the memory is very short term, right? It changes its winding very fast. So.
Well, no, let me give you an alternate way of viewing this, and then I'll try to answer your question in terms of that alternate approach.
So one approach
to viewing this is, so if I give you any function h, you can form a vector field e to the ih. So e to the ih is a unit, is an element of the complex unit circle, and I can associate an arrow to that, an arrow in that direction. So I'm basically just taking the value of h as an angle, and here I'm graphing that angle. So here if h is this linear function of y, then sort of the direction of this arrow just depends on the y-coordinate. Okay, but if I give you any continuous function h, you can draw a corresponding vector field. And now you can look at flow lines of this vector field. And now you essentially what we're doing with this height construction is we're looking at flow lines of the vector field EVIH. Where H is the Gaussian free field. Here's another example where H of xy is x squared plus y squared. So if you think about it, as I follow one of these flow lines, let's say I have a smooth function for now. As I follow this flow line, whenever I'm veering to the left, the value of the height is going up. Right? As I'm veering to the left, this number h has to be going up for me to be veering to the left. So I can think of it as h is describing the amount of winding this path is doing. And when I'm veering to the right, h is going down. So I really think of it as h, I mean certainly if h is a smooth function, this always makes sense. I give you e to the ih. I draw this. Sometimes I like to call this an altimeter compass walk because, well, okay, you can imagine you go hiking and you have one of those analog altimeters in one hand, which shows you your, I mean, it typically has one hand that tells you your height modulo 1,000 feet and one that tells you your height modulo 10,000 feet or something. So you look at the one that tells you your height modulo 1,000 feet, and then hold a compass in your other hand, and turn in such a way that the two arrows point the same direction. Okay? So there's going to be, you know, a unique direction that makes that possible. And if you think about it, the direction in which you're turning is a linear function of your altitude. If I go up, then the altimeter turns and the compass doesn't, so I have to rotate to keep them together. So if you take a walk where you're always keeping these arrows pointing the same way, then you're going to be tracing out the flow line of this. I mean, I like to say that one of the more important practical applications of this work is that it helps you model the trajectories of hikers who hike in this way. Okay, but now you can think of this, it's also sort of a whole geometry, if you like, because I could always, I could add in some alpha, and now I'm going to put in a parameter, chi. So I can take my function h and I can divide it by some parameter and I can add some constant alpha. Alpha changes how I rotate the altimeter in my hand to begin with, and chi changes basically what multiple of the free field I'm looking at, and if you like, it tells me which needle of the altimeter I'm using. Is it height modulo 1,000,000 feet, height modulo 1,000 feet? If it's height modulo 1,000,000 feet, I'm walking more or less in a straight line. My direction changes very little with height, but if it's height modulo 5 feet, then you know I go up even a small hill and I'm already changing direction. Okay, and so I can construct a new sense of direction. I'll say east, I'm going east if I'm at a location. East is the direction I get by taking alpha equals 0. North is what I get by taking alpha equal 0.25, west 0.5, south 0.75. So using that as a modified sense of direction, if you like, this is showing me only the east going arrow. So when I'm over here, this way is east. When I'm over here, this way is east. I have sort of a different notion of north, south, west, and east for every point. So if you like, this is a random geometry, or at least a random affine connection for those who know what that word means. Okay. So if h is equal to 0, then the rays in this geometry are just those of ordinary Euclidean geometry. But more generally, if h is any Lipschitz function, then these rays are well defined. You have a unique path starting at any given point, going in each direction. Now, so it's natural to ask, okay, what is this AC geometry of the Gaussian free field? Okay, so now getting to the question that was asked earlier, one thing you notice is that if I give you two domains and I give you a vector field in this domain, and then I look at a conformal map, say a rotation rotates this vector field. Well, when I rotate the vector field, these arrows are moved, which means if I give you an h here and look at the vector field, and then I rotate it, well, what I do is I get a vector field corresponding to a new h over here. And the new h is equal to the original h plus the argument of the derivative. So if I rotate this by 90 degrees, if I rotate the whole thing by 90 degrees, all of the arrows go right by 90 degrees, so the height is going down by pi over 2. So now when we have this model where we have sort of minus lambda plus winding on the left side and lambda plus winding on the right hand side, if I conformally map this back to my original domain using the conformal map that fixes infinity, and so I map the complement of this back to the original domain, what happens when I do that is, well, all the arrows get distorted, and if I subtract off the argument of this map, then the new boundary height function is just plus or minus lambda. Because if you think about it, if I look at a function that, say, is wound in some number of times, and I look at a conformal map that maps it back to the flat plane, the amount of winding if I look at, say, a small box near this path, say imagine this is a smooth path for now, the amount the box is going to be rotated when I conformally map back is precisely the amount of winding. So it's just the argument of this conformal map is giving me the amount of winding. The other nice thing about this definition of winding is that it makes sense if I replace this by a fractal domain, a fractal path. I mean, for a crazy fractal path, the winding is not defined at, say, a particular point, but this harmonic expectation, harmonic extension of the winding to other points is perfectly well defined, because it's just the argument of this normalizing map, this G sub T. Okay, so so before we take a break, I want to show a couple more pictures. Here, this is the discretized north-going tree when capital E equal to 7. So I took a grid worth of points, and I drew the north-going line starting at those points in this AC geometry. And so one thing you see here is that, you know, because Gaussian free field is such a wildly discontinuous function, you actually have different flow lines sort of converging. So two north-going lines can actually merge into each other. This doesn't happen for smooth functions, but it can happen here. So here, seven. Here I drew the east and the west going lines. I drew, again, I just took a grid worth of points, and I drew the line starting at those points. And I drew the east going ones in black, or in red, and the west going ones in black. And so at least in the limit, these red lines and the black lines are not going to cross each other. And so you'll have an east-going tree. East-going tree, and sort of the dual of the east-going tree will be the west-going tree. This is the north-going tree when capital is equal to 2. So windier. This is related to the uniform spanning tree. So you get this similar pictures there. Here's a north going line when cap equals 3.5. And here's the north going tree when cap equals 3.5. So these flow lines become wilder. They start hitting each other. And a line not only merges into other lines, but it can actually you can actually get this behavior where it will go around it and then hit itself after it has done a loop. So it can't go hit itself like this, but after it's done a winding around itself, then it can hit itself. Which is...
Could you explain again how you get the tree as opposed to the curve? What do you do?
So, So what I do is, I mean, at every point, I have a height function that's giving me a direction. So I pick some hexagon and I first figure out what's the direction from that hexagon, and then from there I just follow the same rule. You know, I pick my initial direction and decide which way I'm going, and then at each step I compare. The value of the new hexagon I reach with the amount of winding I've done so far. So, you know, there's a little question of how you get started, but it doesn't really matter. Once you get started, I have a choice of what my winding is, and each time I hit a new hexagon, I turn left by comparing it, or right by comparing it to my winding so far. So nice facts about these AC lines that you can show from SLE is that if I have rays of differing alpha values, they can sort of cross only if the corresponding Euclidean lines would cross. So if I have a north going line here and a northwest going line here, starting from here, these can cross. But if I have a northeast line starting here, it's not going to cross this path. Okay. So that's, you know,
just look at two paths
started at two points on the real line, say. But if I have two vertical paths that are angled away from each other, they can actually bounce off one another, but not cross, if the angle difference between them is less than the height gap. So I can actually have this northeast line hit the north line and have them bounce off each other at some fractal set. And, okay, a ray may complete a full revolution and hit itself if and only if, well, this height gap is bigger than the amount you get with one rotation. And if you work it out, work out the numbers, you can complete k half revolutions and hit itself if and only if kappa is bigger than 4k over k plus 1. And so when k is numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, these are the values of kappa. So pretty much all the special values of kappa we know correspond to critical points for something like this. You're being able, a path being able to hit itself after k half revolutions. So, you know, here we have two, we have the loop erased random walk, 8/3, we have self-avoiding walk, and Brownian motion boundary. 3, we have the critical easing model. 16 over 5, I don't know, really. What's that?
The tricritical easing model.
The tricritical easing model, okay. And then 10 over 3, I guess we have the Potts model with 3 states. And then if you look at 16 over these values, the dual 8, you have uniform spanning tree boundary. 6, you have percolation. 16 over 3 or 16 over 10/3, you end up getting the FK clusters that are correspond to these systems. And
so those numbers accumulate at 4.
And they accumulate at 4. So I think, you know, people looking at this list initially didn't realize what all these numbers had in common. What they have in common are that they're all 4 times a ratio of 2 consecutive integers. And then when you take 16 over that, you get 4 times the ratio of, also 4 times the ratio of 2 consecutive integers, but with the bigger one on top. And so, you know, all the interesting values of kappa are 4 times the ratio of 2 consecutive integers, which I guess there's a reason for in conformal field theory. Okay, I'll stop there.
So aren't those created, are those values corresponding to minimum models or incremental models?
Yes.
Yeah. The integer and the minimum.
But to be honest, I don't have any, and maybe that's one of the reasons I'm here. I'd like to get someone to explain this to me. I don't have any understanding for why the minimality of a model should correspond to having a property like this. It's sort of a mystery to me.
You have a stunt collection of your own.
So maybe if they're, maybe I should pause for a break at this point.
Let's reconvene in about 5 minutes.
At this point, I'm going to describe an object called the exploration tree. And this is going towards describing these conformal loop ensembles, defining them for different values of kappa. So if I give you any coloring of the hexagons, any black-white coloring, for example, this could be independent percolation coloring, then there is a natural tree you can associate with the coloring as follows. So if I give you an arrow telling you where the starting point of this tree is, and then I give you a point in the interior, and I have to tell you what is the tree, what is the path of the tree that leads to that point. Well, to generate the path into the tree to that point, the rule will be that whenever I hit a black face, I turn right. Whenever I hit a white face, I turn left. And I just keep doing this, but I want the path to be a simple path. It's not allowed to hit itself. So if I ever get to a place where let's say I'm targeting this point over here. If I ever get to a place like this where following the rules would require me to branch away from that point, I then break the rule and instead turn inward. So let me say that again. I have a point I'm targeting, and I'm drawing this path one step at a time following these rules, turning right when I hit black, left when I hit white. If at some point, as I'm generating this path, so here's my target point, I start here. If at some point I'm generating this path, I come to a place where the set of vertices containing this vertex are disconnected from the sort of rest of the vertices in such a way that if I were to follow the direction the rule tells me I should go, I would then be my tip would then be on the boundary of a different component from the component of the complement of what I've got so far that contains my target, then I break the rule. And I have a good explanation for why I broke the rule. I had to break the rule because if I didn't break the rule, then I wouldn't have been able to reach this point with a simple curve. So I take a simple path, and I only break the rule when it becomes clear I absolutely have to. And then I continue following the rule until, again, I have to break it, and I keep going until I get to the inside, until I get to that point. Now, if you if you know computer science, this is the depth first search tree, where each time you hit a face, you search left first if you're hitting a white face, and black first if you're hitting a or right first if you're hitting a black face, left first if you're hitting a white face. And it's sort of clear that this is going to be a tree. And if I pick two distinct points, then the path targeting them is going to be the same up until those two points are sort of separated. So targeting these two points, the path is going to be doing just the same thing up until some point when the path hits a point where it has to branch one way to get to this point and the other way to get to this point. And then it branches.
Oh, sorry, you get a tree by taking different...
So you get a tree by taking the union of this path. So for every point there's a path target at that point, you take the union over all possible targets, and that gives you a tree. And it's a spanning tree, because I take the union over all points. Yes. Okay. So is this clear, this construction? So, one nice thing about this construction is it sort of, it encodes some of what Federico was explaining yesterday. For example, if I fix this point on the boundary condition, say this here, and I ask, what is the tree targeted at that point? But what that tree is going to do is it's going to follow these rules, except when it's at the boundary. When it's on the boundary, it's going to follow the rule that, well, it turns the direction it has to reach the target point. And an equivalent way of saying that is, I just imagine I force boundary conditions to be black around here, and I force boundary or to be, I guess, white around here, is it? Because when I hit white, I turn, when I hit black, I turn right. So if I hit here, I want to try, I make them black around here and white around here, then this is describing that interface between them. So the set of exploration paths targeting boundary points correspond to the path Federico described yesterday, where you just pretend that one arc of the boundary is black and then you draw the interface until you reach that boundary point. Is that clear? So one thing you notice then is that these paths, they tend to trace the boundaries of these loops. So, remember, if I look at this boundary point here, what this path is going to do, let's say I look at this boundary point here, this up in the corner. So there's this arc from here to here, and there are four black, there are four loops. So I define a loop to be a boundary between black and white. There are four loops, and I consider the outside to be white. Everything else, let's say, for the purpose of defining loops, I consider the outside to be white. So if I look at this boundary interval to here, there are one, two, three, four of these loops that intersect that interval. And if I look at this exploration path from here to here, what it does is it traces the boundary of this loop, but not the underside of it, sort of only the outside. Then it comes over here and traces the outside of this loop. Then it comes over here and traces the outside of this loop, and keeps going till it gets over here. And then it comes over here and traces the outside of this loop, and then it goes up to there. So it's tracing half, some partial arc of each of these four loops. But then if I took a look at, if when I got to here, instead of branching that way, I just continued, I could just continue tracing the rest of the boundary of this loop. Okay. Let's see. So another object I just want to show quickly, because I'm going to talk about it later, is this is called the discrete gasket. And what I've done is I've removed all the vertices that are surrounded by a loop. So remember, I think I had some collection of loops, which were these boundaries between black and white. And let me show that little picture again. These I don't have part of my regular slides, but okay. So here, so it's clear there's a one-to-one correspondence between colorings and collections of loops. If I give you any collection of loops and I color the outside white, then you know I just color every hexagon white or black depending on whether it's surrounded by an odd or an even number of loops. And also given the coloring, it's clear how to go back and get the loops from that. So there's a one-to-one correspondence between colorings and loops. And here I just look at these loops, and I look at all the points that aren't surrounded by a loop. So this thing here is surrounded by a loop. But this thing here, there's point here, there's no loop that surrounds it. It's on a loop, but it's not surrounded by any loops. And then, let's see. Here I just remove all the points that are surrounded by loops, and I get something called the gasket. It's the, you may remember these Sierpinski gaskets, these random fractals where you remove pieces. And this is sort of a version of that. I've removed all these chunks, and what I'm left with is called the discrete gasket of a loop ensemble. And the one thing I'm going to discuss later today is a word about what you would expect would happen if you say, so this gasket is now a random graph. And you can ask, what if I do percolation on the faces of this random graph? This has some faces, but some of these lines are a little hard to see over here. There should be lines here. These are all complete hexagons. This is a bad picture. These are all complete hexagons. So
you originally defined it in terms of the vertices of the triangular lattice that went surrounded by loops.
Not of the triangular, of the hexagonal lattice.
The hexagonal lattice, but if you're talking about complete hexagons, then you're really talking about...
The boundaries of these holes are actual loops.
Yes. Right.
So these, they're all the outermost loops.
Hexagons lie on the triangular lattice.
It looks very clear on the screen here if you'd like to come take a look. So now you have a random graph. And one of the things we like to do in physics is ask, well, what happens if you do statistical physics on a random graph? And this is so you could ask, what if you did percolation on this graph? What would you expect the clusters of that to look like? And sort of based on the continuum trees I'll describe today, I can give you a guess for what that should be. But I don't know how to prove it, and I also don't know how to relate my guess to anything that is out there in the physics literature so far.
But that's an objective fractal dimension less than 2.
Yes. It'd be some random fractal, these clusters of this thing. Well, no, the boundaries of these clusters will be fractal dimension less than 2. Clusters themselves, they'll include big things like this, which the gasket itself is going to have a fractal dimension less than 2. Okay. So, let's see, let's go back to the beginning. Okay, so again, with the view, we have this picture. If I color the outside black and white on this side, when I color everything inside, there's a random interface. But now, and we recall, we had the assumption that this interface should look like an SLE. And sort of if you believe in conformal invariance of the scaling limit, then it's sort of clear that any limit of this should have the conformal Markov property. So it should be some SLE. So if I chose these colors according to an ON model, ON loop model, where I kind of weight by both the number of loops and the number of the total length of the loops, then there are conjectures that this scaling limit is going to be some form of SLE kappa. And so it's a theorem, as Federico discussed here earlier, that if the hexagons are chosen by independent Bernoulli percolation, then as the mesh size tends to 0, the scaling limit of this interface is going to be SLE6. And
instead of Bernoulli
percolation, you use the critical easing model, and they also did the set of loops. Okay, if you use the critical easing model, what do you expect the scaling limit of the set of loops to be? So start with all black boundary conditions. What is the scaling limit of the set of all loops? And for a lot of what we do, it's enough to limit our attention to the outermost loops. Because Once you sample the outermost loops, the law of the loops inside one of those loops is the same as the original law after a conformal map. So you can just iterate. Okay. So the various ways of constructing these loop ensembles, and they're defined for all kappa between 8/3 and 8. When kappa is 8/3, they sort of, as kappa approaches 8/3 from above, the loops get smaller and smaller, until when you actually get to 8/3, you have no loops at all. And when kappa approaches 8/3 from below, the loops sort of get, or approaches 8 from below, the loops sort of get bigger and bigger, until when you get to 8, you have a single space-filling loop, which is the outer boundary of the uniform spanning tree. And the simplest way to construct these loop ensembles is what I'll describe, which is this branching S over kappa kappa minus 6. A variant of SLE kappa, I'll describe it in a minute. Another way to get them is when kappa equals 4, is they're the contour lines to the Gaussian free field, where you take your heights to be odd multiples of lambda. So if you think about it, sort of if your original heights are 0 on the boundary, and then you look at these things whose heights are odd multiples of lambda, the outermost ones, the height will be 0 on the outside and either 2 lambda in the inside or minus 2 lambda in the inside of each loop, because there's this 2 lambda height gap between the inside and outside. Okay, anyhow, if you look at that set of contour lines, that'll have a limit which is CLE4. So this joint work with Vendelin is to show that they are also the outer boundaries of the so-called loop soup clusters when 8/3 is equal to less than kappa, equal to less than 4. And that's basically, there's this natural Poissonian way of throwing down random loops. And you take this random set of loops that can intersect each other, and you look at the outer boundaries of these loops. And the outer boundaries give you the outermost loops in a CLE. So I'm not going to describe this in detail in this talk, but it's a nice construction, and it lets you observe some things you couldn't observe otherwise. For example, if you take two CLE3s and two independent copies of CLE3, put them on top of each other, and then look at the clusters of loops. So two loops are connected if they intersect, and look at the clusters of loops you get in this superposition, then the outer boundaries of the clusters will be CLE4. These funny addition properties of loop ensembles that you couldn't see otherwise. And you can also construct them from the Gaussian free field, which I won't say much about today. Okay, so how do you define SLE kappa minus 6? Okay. Now first, what is this SLE kappa rho? So I've been asked to include a definition of this. So recall, when you define SLE, you have this, your path growing, and you look at the conformal map, V sub T, then the image of the tip under the conformal map is what we call W sub T. The tip of the path. So the conformal map that maps the half plane minus the path so far to the half plane and is normalized so that it tends to the identity at infinity, that path, or that conformal map, sends the tip of the path to W sub t. And so when W sub t is moving to the right, this path is sort of veering to the right in a conformal sense. When W sub t is moving to the left, this path is... So when W moves to the right, this path is turning to the right. Yes, that's right. When it moves to the left, this path is turning to the left. And so as W sub t moves up and down, that's sort of guiding whether this path is veering left or right. Now, in some situations, and this is sort of a natural thing to do if, after I've drawn the path so far, this boundary here is sort of equivalent to this boundary. And so now when I go from here, it's sort of, really it's just like being in a new domain with this whole thing as part of the boundary. And that is what happened in the Gaussian free field case when I chose this to be minus lambda. Because then this height was minus lambda and the height along here was essentially minus lambda. But if the original height here were minus 3 lambda or something, some other constant, then this point would sort of be special. This part of the boundary and this part of the boundary would not be the same. So now if I conformally map this back, it makes sense to look at where does this special point here go. The special point goes somewhere. And I sometimes call that the place it goes O sub t. So now instead of just having one special point, W sub t, I have two special points. Okay. Now, so the way this is defined is that W sub t is just a Brownian motion together with a drift term that is rho times or rho divided by the difference between O sub t and W sub t. So, you know, I wrote this
up here,
rho times this difference inverse. So the way you think of that is that there's a force. O sub t exerts a force on W sub t. So if I look at, you know, dW sub t, well, that's going to be root kappa dBt. You know, it's doing a Brownian motion, plus it's also just drifting. There's something dt, and this something is rho over OT minus W sub t.
dBt.
Did I? Yes, dBt. Right.
There was an equation for O.
Well, no, O sub t, O sub t follows the Loebner evolution, which is this, so d O sub t is 2 over, am I going to get the signs right here, O sub t minus W sub t.
Dt.
So just with the Loebner evolution, we know that
all points
here, they're sort of, O sub t is drifting away from W sub t at a speed that is linear in its distance from W sub t. So that's this. O sub t is moving monotonically to the left. And this is the rate at which it's moving. While W sub t is varying wildly with this Brownian motion, but I also have this sort of drift, this wind pushing it and so this, by the way, this isn't an absolute value necessarily. Rho can be positive or negative. And I have this wind pushing this point to the left or to the right.
And should we envision that the two boundaries on the upper figure are now different somehow? The left boundary of the
yeah.
SLE and the left boundary of the left
that.
So what you should envision now is there's sort of three special parts of the boundary. There's this one. There's this, the whole right side. And then there's this. So the boundary has three special parts, and one of the boundary between two of them is the tip. This other one is O sub t.
Is it clear that the point O sub t, which is actually a pair of points, right?
O sub t. Oh, because I could have one on the other side. I'm only looking at one side.
Oh.
So I'm only looking at the left side. There are variants of where you include points on both sides. So they call these. So this is SLE kappa rho. There's SLE kappa rho 1, rho 2. Where you have points on both sides. Or, I mean, and there's no reason you couldn't have points on, you couldn't have several points out here, each of them contributing a drift to W sub t. And this, I mean, this I understand is also fairly natural in the conformal field theory framework. You have these special marked points on the boundary that you can understand. So it turns out there's something special about rho equals kappa minus 6. Something special. And so I'll say what that is. Let's imagine. So first of all, I can fix any initial values for O sub t and W sub t. I can fix, say, O sub 0 and W sub 0 to be any starting values. So
here,
in this picture
over here,
sort of at time equals 0, O sub t and W sub t were together. But I could also imagine that I made my green extend a little bit this way, so that O sub t started here and W sub t started here. So I can give you any choice of values for O sub 0, W sub 0, and then draw this path. And it turns out, if I set rho equal to kappa minus 6, then the law of this path is the same up until the first time that O sub t is swallowed. So that happens at some point, O sub t gets swallowed. And if kappa is... Okay, but up until the first time O sub t gets swallowed, this path looks like an SLE from W sub t to O sub, from W0 to O0. Looks like an ordinary SLE. So let's think that again. If I tell you I want an SLE from W0 to O0, but I'm going to draw that path, but I'll renormalize as though I'm in the half plane with my point at infinity being fixed. So at each point, as I start drawing this path, I can component that back. I have this G sub t. I can look at where these O0 and W0 go. And the law, the way they behave, is like an SLE kappa minus 6. That's a simple calculation you can do. This is written in a paper by Oded Schramm and David Wilson, where they work out a bunch of these. They just call it coordinate changes of SLE. If instead of viewing an SLE from its target point, I sort of pick another point to normalize by, what does it look like? Well, it just looks like SLE kappa minus 6. But if I want, once I reach this point, well, I can now say, what am I going to do? Well, I'm either going to continue until I get here. Well, if I were doing a regular SLE, I would turn inwards and keep going till this point. But since I'm not doing a regular SLE, I have to keep going because I'm targeting infinity. So I have to sort of branch out this direction. So this SLE kappa, kappa minus 6, it's like an SLE, except that when it hits the boundary, it sort of, instead of going towards its target, it goes the other direction. It goes towards infinity. Now, one way to construct this SLE, so this SLE kappa minus 6 is it's a path. So when kappa is bigger than 4, it's a path that does this. It keeps hitting the boundary and hitting itself, and it goes to infinity. And it's only if you stop at some time and ask, okay, what's it doing until the next time it hits the boundary? Well, it's just doing an SLE. And it sort of makes sense from from the perspective of the exploration tree pictures, where I have some. If I imagine I start with all black boundary conditions, let's say all green boundary conditions, and then I start exploring one of these interfaces, what I'm doing now is I'm seeing black on or green on one side and orange on the other. And so after I've seen this, what this is going to do is keep, and then at some point I come down here and close this off, and then maybe I go off like this. But I'm always seeing orange on the left and green on the right. Now at this point in time, when I'm up here, what does the domain I'm exploring look like? Well, in the domain I'm exploring, I have orange on the boundary, I have orange on this arc, and I have green everywhere else. So the law of this path should just be doing an SLE targeted at this point, where orange and green separate. What that suggests is SLE kappa minus 6 is the right thing to look at for what the boundary of this exploration tree should be. One way to generate SLE kappa kappa minus 6 is the following. I start at my point 0, and I just pick a point epsilon units to the left, and I draw an SLE targeted at that point. And then after I reach it, and then the first time that point is swallowed, I pick a point epsilon to the left of that, and draw an SLE targeted at that until it's swallowed. And then I pick a point epsilon to the left of, again, where I hit when the point got swallowed, and continue. And you see, when you do this, you'll get mostly little loops, but occasionally you'll get a really big loop. It'll go out. And so you get this, and as epsilon tends to zero, this converges to SLE kappa kappa minus 6. Okay, that's what you do when kappa is equal to or greater than 4. And this all makes perfect sense. And the SDEs make perfect sense. When kappa is equal to or less than 4, there are some caveats that I have to mention. Which is, so when kappa is less than or equal to 4, first of all, the way SLE kappa rho was originally defined doesn't really make sense. Because if you try to solve the SDE, then you don't get a solution. And sort of, the reason is, if you think I'm just tracing the boundary, these loops to hit the boundary, as kappa gets to 4, converges to 4 from above, I'm getting smaller and smaller, fewer. The places where loops hit the boundary are becoming sparser and sparser. And so this path is becoming more and more like a straight line, just hugging the left-hand side, until when you get to kappa equals 4, that's what you get, just a straight line, hugging the left side. And so SLE kappa, kappa minus 6, for any, whenever kappa is less than 4, that means your rho is less than minus 2, this object isn't really quite making sense. On the other hand, there is a way to make sense of this if you use what are called principal values. And so I'm not going to tell you what those are, but I will tell you what you can do to approximate an SLE kappa kappa minus 6 less than 4. What you do is, so you pick a point. So if I did this thing where I pick a point epsilon to the left, do an SLE to that. Pick a point epsilon to the left, do an SLE to that. Pick a point epsilon to the left, draw an SLE to that. When kappa is less than 4, these SLEs, these are all simple paths. And so I just get this chain of simple paths, and this is, well, as epsilon goes to 0, this is just converging to the line. I'm getting nothing. But suppose each time I draw this path, instead of starting from the same point where my tip was, I jump a little bit to the right before I start again. So what happens is, I draw this SLE, and then what I'll do is I'll shift my W sub T, my tip of the path, I'll shift it a little bit to the right, and then I'll pick a new target point of the path, say somewhere down here, and I'll draw another loop. Then I'll shift to the right, pick a new target point, and draw another loop. Shift to the right, pick a new target point, draw another loop, or another path. And if I choose the amount I add to the right each time, just right, so it's a particular multiple of epsilon, if I choose that multiple correctly, then this thing will have a limit. And it'll be a limiting path that basically, it draws loops. And all of the loops, it's tracing them clockwise, if W sub T is continuous, or counterclockwise, I guess. But then it's also kind of climbing the loops, or sort of climbing up. So it's actually tracing out a set of loops in the interior. And this is sort of confusing in that these loops don't hit the boundary. Actually, none of these loops hit the boundary. And you say, well, how do I get loops that don't hit the boundary when I'm starting on the boundary? What happens is I trace infinitely many microscopic loops before I hit my first macroscopic one. And so the place this big one start is sort of on the boundary of a set of a sequence of much, much smaller loops. So for this SLE kappa kappa minus 6, it's a well-defined Lobner evolution. And these excursions, the time W sub T and O sub T are escaping away from 0, and each excursion you trace one loop. Okay. And so that's how you define these loops. Now there's a parameter you can play with beta, where you alter each time you close a loop, you randomly decide whether the next loop you'll trace clockwise or counterclockwise. And beta equals 1 says you trace them all clockwise. Beta equals 2, all counterclockwise. And in between, you have the appropriate linear combination of the two. Okay. Now it turns out, so when I define principal values, there's some, there can be, there are various ways to define it. And when this O sub T minus W sub T is 0, I can do various things. I can add local time shifts. I can decide if I want the process to be shifting a little to the right when it's 0, shifting a little to the left. But it turns out that if you want scale invariance in the Markovian property, there are only so many things you can get away with. And basically, when kappa is not equal to 4, you only have the parameter beta to deal with. Otherwise, it's completely determined. And when kappa is equal to 4, you don't even have beta to deal with. Beta has to be 0. But you have an additional parameter mu, which is this sort of a local time push you can add, making these things drift left or right. Okay, so, and so in this paper draft I have, I call these things SLE, I think, mu beta kappa, kappa minus 6. So I have these parameters, I'm adding this kind of local time shift with this mu and this, this beta telling me the probability of doing left or right. Given one of these processes, there's something called the trunk of the process. And the trunk, so first of all, we don't have a proof that these things are continuous, these processes, although I believe that's the case. The trunk is the set of points that you hit at times when O sub t is equal to W sub t. So the way I think of it is, we have this sort of trunk, which is this path with fruit on either side of it, which are these loops. And all the loops are disjoint from each other. No two loops intersect. But every loop intersects the trunk at some point where there's the first point on the trunk where the loop got started. And so as this path goes, it traces the loops on the right, it traces clockwise, the loops on the left, it traces counterclockwise. And depending on beta, you'll have more or less on the left or right side of this trunk. And, okay, and that's this object you have. Now, what I believe is this trunk is the interface between the percolation clusters. If you do percolation on this, you do the appropriate percolation on the gasket. So you do a percolation on the gasket where you, so basically the things on the left correspond to the left, left side, and the things on the right correspond to the right side. And if it's percolation with constant p equals 1/2, then I would expect this to work. If it's a different constant, then you have to also change the probability for the microscopic clusters to compensate for the macroscopic ones. So I'll discuss more about this if anyone wants. I should probably wrap up here quick. So so let me just say two open problems I think are kind of interesting. One open problem is to give a continuum version of the FK cluster decomposition. So remember what the FK cluster decomposition is. It says if I want to choose a Potts model with, say, three states, what I can do is first choose one of these FK clusters, which is a random subgraph of my graph. And so I first sample one of these clusters, and then I randomly pick a color to color each of the components. So I color all the vertices on this one purple, this one green, this one green, this one green, this cluster, I'll make the whole thing yellow. Let's say this one's purple, this one's green. So I can do this two-step process. First I choose this cluster, and then I assign a spin to each of these. Well, it's believed that if I look at the boundaries of these clusters, the boundaries of these clusters, I guess there's no edge there, this should go in, should converge to CLE for some kappa between 4 and 8. But now there's sort of a parity issue that if I look at the the outermost clusters, these describe the outside of a cluster, and then if I look at the next level in, these I have clusters like this, loops like this one that describes sort of the inside boundary of a cluster. So if I wanted to say what is a continuum cluster is, I take a continuum loop, I take its closure, I mean this is a, well it is closed, the set of points hit by that loop, I subtract all the points surrounded by loops that are inside. And so I get a random closed set. And so each, so I, any point I take an odd cluster minus what's inside, all the even things inside. So I get this random collection of clusters, which I think of as being continuum FK clusters. And I have an adjacency relation. Two clusters are adjacent if they intersect. And sometimes they can intersect on the inside. If a cluster has a hole, I can have a cluster inside it that intersects it. But anyhow, I have these continuum clusters. And I can ask, well, if I randomly assign a color to each of these continuum clusters, and I look at the clusters of clusters I get, do I get the continuum limit of the Potts model for kappa, say, for q equal to 2, 3, or 4? And if so, what I would expect to get is this, I would have a way of generating CLE kappa for kappa between 8/3 and 4. That's what I expect for the boundaries of the Potts model, the critical Potts model. I would be able to construct that out of SLE 16 over kappa, or CLE 16 over kappa, using this procedure. And then the second question is, can I understand percolation on the gasket? Where the gasket corresponds to kappa less than 4, I think that that might give you a way to generate CLE 16 over kappa from CLE, or might give you a way to construct loops that look like 16 over kappa with kappa bigger than 4 from, well, might give you a way to start with these things where it's smaller than 4 and hook them together in some way so their boundaries give you things where kappa is bigger than 4. Okay, I will end there.
There might be some delicate issues when you want to find the clusters in this way.
Why?
Well, I don't think it, I think it should work. We have a similar construction in the cluster for the percolation case. So you take a loop and you look at what's inside the loop, and then you remove whatever is inside the loop, contained inside that loop, without removing the loops themselves. These are sort of fractal objects, and you.
Yes.
I think a priori it's not clear that what you get is even a connected set. There could be issues with this type of
No, if the curve is connected, then this is connected. I'm keeping the original. Well, okay.
No, we could have pieces that are it's connected, but it could be. I don't think it really happens, but I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. That might be.
I might have complained about the sort of construction.
Because we have the analogous construction for Berkeley.
I think you have to use properties of the SLEs and CLEs rather than general open curves.
To make sure that things don't get.
To prove that this is connected. Yeah, I'm sure in there.
I think I remember.
There's work to be done. You know, I should say that for CLE between 4 and 8, we don't even at this point have a proof that the loops themselves are continuous. So that's a basic enough question, right? These loops should be continuous. You know, we don't quite have a proof of that, just because we don't have a proof that SLE kappa rho processes are continuous. And, you know, we believe they are. It's probably not even that hard to do, but no one has done it. So yeah, there are certainly some fundamental questions. And yeah, and so for these clusters, you can start by asking, you know, are they path connected, say? And that may already be a non-trivial question. But first of all, that question is not really necessary for the question I'm asking. But yes, okay.
If there are any more questions, let's start again.